Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores. You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy. But Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
The Fall of the House of FIFA is a scintillating new big book by David Kahn. FIFA was founded in 1904 to unite the football playing world, its first congress stating that no person should be allowed to arrange matches for personal profits. Of course, as scandal upon scandal broke in the past 5 to 10 years, FIFA has become a byword for corruption. It is this subject that David Kahn looks at in his new book, Fall of the House of FIFA. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. David Kahn. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, FIFA has become, as we said, a byword for corruption. It wasn't always like this.
No, I mean, it wasn't like it for a long time, and that was one of the elements I really wanted to establish in the book. I didn't want to just write a book about corruption, a sort of one-dimensional, they're all thieves, they're all gangsters, here's the guilty men, here's the guilty documents, you know, and all in one tone. For me, what makes this scandal, if you like, really special and almost more scandalous is that we're talking here about football. And we're actually talking about the world governing body of football, FIFA. And what we've got at the same time as a quite incredible story of corruption, I mean, probably the biggest story and series of corruption scandals ever in sport, an astonishing amount of corruption to come out of one organisation and to come out of sport. But first of all, the scale of the betrayal is greater, I think, because you're talking about the betrayal of a great simple game that's loved and passionately supported all around the world. But second of all, FIFA itself actually has got a great history of developing football, of developing the World Cup, of having the World Cup, of organising the World Cup. And so I wanted to root it in this history. And the history, which is fascinating to me, is the same as the history of just about every sports organisation in the world. You know, they start off in the late 19th century, or in FIFA's case, 1904, after football associations have already been formed. They get together in an office in Paris, seven countries. Britain held back at first, which is quite a familiar story to us, Britain holding back from European cooperation, if you like. And it was completely amateur, really. I mean, there really wasn't much money in football in those countries. And they got together to be able to organise games against each other. And really, there would always have been politicking, and there was quite a lot of politicking, but there wasn't really very much money in FIFA until you got into the modern era of multi-million dollar TV deals. And that's really when the corruption started. Now, I don't think we've got a completely simple story of great innocence and idealism before that, and then, you know, rotten corruption in the modern era. I think it's always a greyer area than that. And I think that we should recognise FIFA has done really good work, good development work, and has got actually an amazing record of developing this game from that sort of backroom meeting in 1904 to this huge global game that we know today. But at the same time, corruption and, to be honest, sort of self-serving politics has been rooted through the backbone of that organisation in the modern era.
You start the book with looking at many would say is a golden age, a halcyon age of many sporting organisations, which is perhaps the late 60s, early 70s. Everybody remembers the 66 World Cup. Everybody remembers the 1970 Mexico World Cup and the impact that players like Cruyff made and the beautiful game and total football. And it's interesting because that coincides with a change of the guard in FIFA with Havelange. Was it Havelange or Havelange coming into...
Yeah.
into
yeah.
And from that point... Rather than before, when the game could be seen as almost a calling in terms of working with FIFA, it changed. The first changes started to creep in there.
Exactly, and I mean, it's always been well known that 1974 was the watershed for FIFA, because that was the World Cup in West Germany, as it was then. That was won by the West Germany, captained by Franz Beckenbauer, who beat the Holland of Johan Cruyff in the final. And as I say in the book, that's the first World Cup that I can remember watching on television, because I was 9 years old and I was captivated, like so many people are when they're kids, by watching this amazing spectacle on television. And that's my opening chapter of the book, partly because, you know, it's just true and it's my memory of watching the first World Cup. But the reason for chronicling it in that way is because I wanted to establish that this whole story of politics and corruption takes place against in a context of a game that people absolutely love, that people have fallen in love with from a very young age. And watching the World Cup on television is a formative experience for people that everyone remembers, and is a formative experience in falling in love with football. And for me, it's just, you know, a huge coincidence that World Cup, which was my first, which I watched with such innocence, was also the date of the election of the president, which obviously when you're a kid you know nothing about, but in the history of FIFA, understanding it, if you like, as a grown-up, as a journalist, chronicling this incredible story, the president was an English former secretary of the English FA called Sir Stanley Rouse, and I've researched and chronicled his career, which is an astonishing career of, you know, if you like, the ultimate FA blazer, but in a good way, but possibly in a bad way as well, but an amazing career. He was knighted for organising the 1948 London Olympics. He's one of those life stories that you can trace from the very, very early days of sport. He used to cycle 20 miles to watch Norwich City in their own, from his tiny little village in Suffolk, to watch Norwich City in their old ground before they even moved to Carrow Road. And he ends up, you know, organising the World Cup in Mexico, the most famous World Cup, the Pelé, Brazil's third World Cup triumph in Mexico, shown live in colour all around the world. Sir Stanley Rouse had his day, really, and he was outvoted and outmaneuvered by João Havelange, the Brazilian business figure who had been the prime mover of Brazil's success, and who engineered an election victory in a way that sort of almost professionalised the politics at FIFA. But also, we already knew that Havelange was corrupt and did take bribes. What I didn't know until writing the book, and which I think will be new to most people, is how far back that went. I mean, we're tracing it right back to even the, probably from the 70s, all the way through. He's taking bribes and kickbacks. He was never on a salary. And with Havelange again, Giles, you've got a mix, I think, and I've tried to portray some of these characters not one-dimensionally, because, you know, classically, you would paint anyone who's taken bribes as just a gangster, basically, wouldn't you? Or, you know, a corrupt person. But with Havelange, like with many of these characters, I think you have to recognise his legacy of development, that from 1974, FIFA did hugely develop football. They expanded the World Cup. They had a development programme which Sepp Blatter, who became his successor as president, his first job was to come in and do the development programme, which went to Africa with coaching programmes and technical development. And money did pour into development as well as into people's pockets through that period. But 1974, if you like, the year of my football innocence, was the year, the watershed year for FIFA's loss of innocence, if you like.
It's interesting that you bring up Blatter. Obviously, he is painted now as a very one-dimensional character, seeming to be scheming and grabbing and taking everything he could and everything that's wrong with football. You managed to secure an interview with him at FIFA's own restaurant on a hill overlooking Zurich. And if you're looking, I knew nothing about FIFA having their own restaurant.
Neither did I, Giles. Neither did I. Basically, yeah, Sepp Blatter agreed to an interview, which was great, because I wanted to talk to him properly and put all these points to him. And also, I already felt again that he also wasn't a one-dimensional character, and that he did have a legacy of development. And also, when you talk to people about Sepp Blatter, they say that he's got some qualities. You know, some people say that he's actually well-intentioned and he was doing what he could within a bad system to try to advance FIFA. Some people don't. Some people say he's completely ruthless and obviously self-seeking. But there's a mix there. And so he agreed to see me in Zurich, and they sent me the address. And I made my way up. I mean, for people who haven't been to Zurich, it's a sort of picture-perfect Swiss city. I mean, it really is just so. It's very wealthy. And you get the tram up the hill, and then you walk through this suburb, which is very, I wouldn't say plush, but just so comfortable, like incredibly quiet. It's like the quiet reminded me of a sofa. It was almost like walking through, the whole suburb was like, you know, a really comfortable sofa. Anyway, we got to this restaurant, and I saw that there was a flag out the front, and it was the FIFA flag. And then the waitress, I was early, and then the waitress came to just give me some water while I was waiting, and she had a FIFA polo shirt on. And then gradually I realised, of course, this is the hill where the old FIFA headquarters was before they moved to this huge new $240 million bunker, as people call it, next to the zoo in Zurich on another hill. And FIFA owned it's FIFA's restaurant. And so Sepp Blatter, who was already banned at that stage by FIFA, his choice of place to meet for an interview was still FIFA's own restaurant. And next door to the office where obviously he'd made his way in life to his ultimate ambition of being president of FIFA, which I thought was, you know, it's so revealing in itself. Just before you even start talking, the choice of place for the band president was still his old haunt, if you like, where he was the boss. And as you'll know from reading the book, he did say at the end to me, he said, "I'm still the boss here."
Mm. And very interestingly, the other thing is the fact that you know FIFA became so big and so political in those years that it was perhaps always going to happen that the figures would move in who didn't share the love of the people's game that, you know, perhaps figures like Cruyff did, and the CONCACAF nations. So the famous story about, you know, if you're looking for an illustration of how crazy a lot of the FIFA expenditure was, it was, of course, Chuck Blazer and his apartment in Trump Tower for his cats.
Sepp Blatter would get cross about us saying that that had anything to do with FIFA. And as I say in my book, he does have a point there. So when, like, the bulk of the corruption that has been exposed and that is the subject of the huge criminal investigation in America led by the FBI and the Department of Justice, that led to the arrests in Zurich that everybody can remember that blew it all into the open in May 2015. Actually, Blatter, you know, he's really frustrated by this being laid at FIFA's door because the vast bulk of the corruption, which is alleged bribery and kickbacks, paid to football officials when they were selling the TV rights to TV companies to tournaments, they were taking millions of dollars in bribes, right? But Blatter has got a point, definitely, that this was not FIFA tournaments. These were the tournaments of the what they call confederations, which is the regional football organizations, which in America is South America, called CONMEBOL, which is your Argentina's, your Brazil's, and their tournaments. And in North America and the Caribbean is called CONCACAF, the Confederation of North, Central, American and Caribbean Football Associations. And Blatter seeds that so much of this was dollars being taken in the Americas, but they staged the arrests in Zurich, and the Americans laid all the corruption at FIFA's door in Zurich, right? And not only was it American corruption, but it was right at the heart of America. It was in Trump Tower in Manhattan, where Chuck Blazer, who was the General Secretary of CONCACAF, you know, he's pleaded guilty now to bribery, corruption, tax evasion. And as you say quite rightly, he had his apartment in Trump Tower. Then he had another apartment, and it turned out that that apartment was basically only lived in by his cats, who'd peed everywhere. And that is, as you say, an incredible all you need to know, really, about the rancid corruption of FIFA figures, right? But in terms of FIFA itself, what FIFA is the organisation for all the national football associations of the world. So 211 football associations all belong to FIFA, just as the founders of FIFA envisaged in 1904, one FA for each country that are all united, that play in the same World Cup. And that is a marvellous achievement. You know, let's recognise that. It's phenomenal to think how this sport has grown in a century, just over a century. And at FIFA, but where Blatter's resentment has to stop is that there was corruption endemic in FIFA as well. But where that corruption was, in Havelange's time, there were bribes paid to him and others on the sale of actual World Cup TV rights by FIFA itself. But also what you have, obviously, at FIFA is votes for who's going to host the World Cup. And you also have votes for who's going to be the president. Now, I don't think we've got proven corruption on the votes for president. And as Sepp Blatter says, he's not currently indicted or charged with any actual corruption. And that's true, he isn't. And his ambition was clearly to be the president of FIFA. You know, so far there are no charges against him for corruption, but there is a lot of evidence and allegations and ongoing investigations into alleged corruption in World Cup votes at FIFA. Mm.
I mean, we've got the Russia World Cup next year, and then we've got the Qatar World Cup, which perhaps the most controversial World Cup decision ever made, I would think. Where do you think FIFA can go from here?
Well, I mean, those two World Cups, at the moment, I mean there have been there's ongoing investigations into the voting process, which was in December 2010, where what was called the Executive Committee of FIFA which at the time was 22 people, because two were already suspended for ethics breaches. So 22 people left, including Chuck Blazer and others who are now either pleaded guilty or banned or under investigation, voted for Russia and Qatar. Now, there are some instances of alleged corruption that have come out of the investigations already, but they were deemed by FIFA not to be enough to take the World Cups off Russia and Qatar. And those World Cups are clearly going ahead. But and Blatter wanted America to host 2022, not Qatar. Blatter is not, you know, complicit in the World Cup going to Qatar. And what Sepp Blatter told me, and what he said publicly anyway before, is the one person that we know voted for Qatar was Michel Platini, who was at the time the president of UEFA, the European Confederation. And Platini has openly said that he went to a lunch with the president of his own country, Nicolas Sarkozy, and the emir, the person who is now the emir of Qatar, the ruler of Qatar. And it was essentially made clear to him at that meeting that the president of his country wanted him to vote for Qatar, because there would be benefits to the country. And that is the level on which this was played, on actual rulers of countries. And France did huge trade deals with Qatar afterwards, and also Qatar bought, Qatari interests bought Paris Saint-Germain, the, you know, the Parisian football club that Sarkozy supports. Platini says, you know, He still says that he wasn't influenced by that and that he made his own mind up. But Blatter is bitter about this and says that's what changed everything. He voted for Qatar afterwards. So, and Blatter said to me, don't look for bribery. Don't look for sort of cashing brown envelopes for the World Cup votes. He said, look at high politics, because Platini changed his vote and three other European votes were changed. And obviously, Vladimir Putin was very, very involved with the Russia bid, because these are hugely prestigious events for countries to host. It's not just done by the FA president anymore, who might be, you know, and then there's suspicions about what they might get for voting a certain way. None of them proven in these cases. But this is geopolitical, you know, high stakes politics. And when you say, where does FIFA go from here? FIFA needs to marry that level of prestige, that level of money that is made from selling the TV rights and selling the sponsorships, the difficulties, because let's recognise it, the enormous difficulties of running an a truly global organisation where every country in the world is represented. And it's an amazing achievement to have that and keep the show on the road. But they have to marry that with, if you like, the love and the innocence that we all have for football, and the expectation that we have that football will be a force for good in the world. And it's when we see the scale in which football was not a force for good in the world, and in which people exploited football's appeal to line their own pockets, that's when we feel deeply betrayed, you know, more betrayed than if when we just, you know, understand or read about corruption just in an industry. You know, sometimes it's not that shocking. It's wrong, it's illegal, but it's not that shocking. Whereas this, you know, we feel is truly disgraceful and outrageous. So FIFA needs to embody what it claims to embody, which is to be for the good of sport and a force for good in the world.
The book is, sorry, David, the book is called, alas, I'm going to run out of time, has beat me on this one. The book is called The Fall of the House of FIFA. It's by David Cullen. It comes out on Yellow Jersey. If people want to find out more about yourself or about the book, is there social media? Is there a website they can visit?
Yeah, so the book, if they Google The Fall of the House of FIFA, they'll find it for sale on the publisher's website or on Amazon. My own Twitter is at David_Con. You know, I write for The Guardian, this is my fourth book. And thanks for having me on, and I hope people enjoy the read. I've tried to make it an engaging read, as I say, that it's wrapped in a love and a passion for the game itself and the history of the game itself, and that the character and that the characters are portrayed as real people, you know, and there's, I hope, a warmth in the book, which means that it's a good read as well as a chronicle of bad deeds.
The book's called The Fall of the House of FIFA. David Corn, thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much.
That was an interview I did, a little bit earlier on, actually the end of last year, with David Corn, author of The Fall of the House of FIFA. Fascinating stuff, and I still can't get over the fact that FIFA have their own restaurant.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.